Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi, and here on EWTN, we once again have this awesome privilege to come together to hear a story of faith and conversion. We're joined tonight by Christopher O'Keefe. He's a former Mennonite pastor. He came to the church in 2022, and we're honored to have him here tonight. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's such an honor to have you, and got many, many interesting parts of your story tonight. We were chatting about a number of them before the show today, but it's great to have you here. Let's go back to the beginning and start your story off. And you mentioned before the show, even there is some Catholicism in your background before you came on the scene. Tell us a little bit about that.
Some Catholicism in my family's background, so much myself,
sure.
but it does start there with my dad. So my dad was raised in a Catholic home, 12 brothers and sisters, you know, large Catholic family, yeah. Irish Catholic family. My mom was raised Methodist. So when they got together and were talking about, you know, getting married and considering her joining the Catholic Church, you know, my dad had become very devout, you know, Christian, was in the scriptures, you know, prayer meetings and Bible studies and loved the Lord. And so my mom said, well, hey, well, let's look into the doctrines. And if this is where, you know, where I belong, then she'll join. And so anyways, you know, as they went through that process and talking to local clergy and reading the scriptures and looking at the doctrines, they were some of those that found, like, we don't think this matches up to what the scriptures teach. Long story short, they left the church. So my dad did not continue practicing Catholicism mm-hmm. before I was born, but still really devout, non-denominational, kind of charismatic background. That was what I was born into, but a very devout home. We had Bible study every day before school. We had to read our Bible every day after school, you know, in church whenever the doors open. My dad did pastoring and prison ministry, mission work, and so that was kind of my world that I was raised in.
What part of the country was that?
We were in South Mississippi. Spent a few years in Kansas, but South Mississippi on the Gulf Coast there.
All right.
For the majority of my life, and so that was kind of my upbringing, you know, around a family that just loved the Lord a lot and served the Lord any way they could. And then I kind of went the way of the world and started a business and got married and kind of just doing my own thing. Mm-hmm. And it was when my dad passed away in 2011, that me and my brothers were talking about maybe getting into doing some ministry. He had been doing some prison ministry. We thought, well, hey, there's a gap here, mm-hmm. you know, one less person doing ministry in the jails. Maybe we could help out. And so then when me and my brothers went and approached the local jail chaplain, he put us in charge of a Sunday morning church service. Mm-hmm. And at the time we were kind of practicing it in the kind of messianic Hebrew roots world. And my dad had kind of started doing that with us maybe when my early teens. Mm. And so that was kind of our world as far as practice goes, but very non-denominational, strict Bible only, kind of sola scriptura. You know, whatever the Bible taught, and for him, this was kind of where it all led. It seemed to be it was taking the whole Bible seriously is the way a lot of the people would have kind of saw it.
Yeah, you mentioned that very very strict kind of Bible focused upbringing there. Where did I know you said you were non-denominational, but you know, theologically, what were sort of the emphasis in terms of works and prayer and salvation? Where did you kind of fit in that picture growing up?
So whenever like the faith, my faith became my own, whenever I like really got serious about the Lord myself, you know, my family, we were practicing kind of in that messianic world. Mm-hmm. And so in that world there, you know, one of the distinctives is the commandments.
Yeah.
You know, Jesus kind of, they come from Jesus' teaching, you know, not one jot or tittle will pass from the law. And so if you start to add in a lot of these commandments and see like, hey, well, hey, this is the things we should be practicing. Quickly, you can end up in that kind of works righteousness world. And so, you know, it was kind of like, you know, yes, we receive God's mercy and His grace by, you know, repentance and faith and accepting that. But then you must then do the commandments. You know, if you, like Jesus teaches, if you love me, do the commandments. And so we you know, jumped into that and quickly it produces a lot of legalism, a lot of easy to fall in self-righteousness and also easy to judge others and, you know, this kind of strictness sure. around that. So, so that was kind of, you know, some of yeah. that world that I ended up in, you know, in my 20s.
Okay. What did worship look like at that point in your life? Did you worship with a community or was it kind of a house church thing?
House church, I would say, you know, like in our community, there might have been, you know, 8 to 10 families that did something similar. We would all get together on different feast days, you know, whether it was Pentecost or Passover or Feast of Tabernacles, things like that. We would get together, you know, each family kind of did things a little differently. Mm-hmm. And so we had like a loose association, not really much church per se. You know, we would keep like a Saturday Sabbath and and rest and get together and break bread and have a meal and and things like that. So
that's a form of Christianity that a lot of people aren't familiar with, sort of this messianic focus, trying to, would you characterize it as trying to kind of connect with the Jewish roots of Christianity? Is that kind of the focus of that?
Yeah. Yeah. One of the ways that we would see it is like, one of the things the Reformation was trying to do was get closer to the New Testament church in their words and their ideas. Sure. And for us, we were saying, well, hey, we don't think they went far enough.
Yeah.
You know, we need to get back to, you know, Jesus was Jewish. The apostles were Jewish. How would we understand the New Testament writings in light of that? What would their practice look like? You know, they would have been in the synagogues and scriptures being read and keeping Passover. And so there was a, you know, that was kind of the focus, you know, taking all the scriptures seriously. We would have seen it like you know, the Protestants that didn't go that far hadn't taken sola scriptura all the way to its logical conclusion. Right. And that's, you know, so we were kind of going that direction.
Okay.
And we're there.
You mentioned, just before we get back to the narrative there, just you mentioned you kind of went the way of the world. You know, where were you in terms of your own relationship with the Lord, your own kind of faith and moral journey up through this time?
So like, you know, out of high school time frame was just kind of like, you know, by the way of the world, I just meant like always believed.
Yeah.
Religion wasn't really like important to me, you know, and because like my family wasn't, you know, worshiping in like a certain church where we were like devoted and committed, then, you know, just didn't go to church, didn't worship, didn't think much about it. You know, went to college, you know, got married, started businesses and just kind of did my own thing. After I got married, my dad gave me a Bible. Interestingly enough, it was a New Jerusalem Bible, which happens to be a Catholic Bible.
Oh, yeah.
And though he wasn't Catholic, he had fallen in love with the Old Testament. In that particular Bible has God's name instead of the places where a lot of translations use, you know, capital Lord. And so he was like, you know, it's like a restoring the original scriptures kind of idea. Anyway, he gave me this Bible and I decided to get back into Bible reading like I had done as a child. Just thought this is the right Christian thing to do. I still considered myself a Christian. So I started reading the scriptures and every day. And, you know, a few years in, really felt the conviction of the Lord, that I had just been like, not really focused on him. I was living my own way. And, so I kind of had my repentance moment. This was in January of 2009, had my repentance moment, turned to the Lord and kind of resubmitted to my dad, spiritually. You know, we had a good relationship, but it was kind of like, I went to him and I said, you know, hey, I've been doing my own thing, but I'm ready to, you know, you know, we didn't have a church. So, you know, my dad and the family there was kind of the church. And so I was like, hey, let's start getting together once a week on the Sabbath and let's start being more intentional. And I want to participate in this.
Yeah.
And,
what was your wife's background spiritually?
Yeah. So she was raised, Baptist, you know, in the Southern Mississippi there, we have large Catholic communities, and large Southern Baptist communities. So she was raised in the Baptist church, but she'd gone to Catholic school her whole life as well. So she was exposed to a lot of the Catholic teachings because you have to take the religion classes and things like that. But so she was raised Baptist. When we got married and then, you know, I kind of moved into after coming into repentance and faith in the Lord and like this kind of renewed thing in 2009. And we had been married for about 4 years at that point. She was willing to kind of, you know, come along with me and follow me. And we, you know, as we worship together and pray together you know, and got into the scriptures and everything, then, you know, she was more than willing to, let me lead spiritually, if you will, and mm-hmm. and just came along and practiced that. So she had, you know, she was used to kind of seeing one thing and then, you know, seeing different traditions and different ways of practicing Christianity. And, mm-hmm. you know, she saw the good in all of it. She right. she was never very dogmatic
yeah.
about like, oh, these guys are wrong and I'm right or mm-hmm. I'm wrong and they're right or whatever, you know, yeah. so.
So this brings you up to that time period. You said your father was doing prison ministry?
Yeah, he was doing prison ministry. Okay. So when I, you know, come to like being, you know, this devout life with the Lord in 2009, he passed away in 2011. Okay. And so me and my brothers decided, well, hey, Dad's not doing jail ministry anymore. He passed away. Let's go reach out and get into the jail. And so, you know, my brothers both do music. I didn't have any of that music talent. So they're like, okay, you're going to preach, you know, we'll do the music.
Thanks, guys.
yeah. And they both preached, you know, some too, but I was preaching most weeks.
Sure.
And then as you have that burden of like, hey, I'm sharing to 35, 40, 45 guys every week. I need to make sure I'm like putting in the prep time. I need to make sure that I'm like really studying this out and you know, I'm representing the Lord and delivering his word to these folks. And so I just fell in love with ministry. I just yeah. fell in love with, you know, that, I had the business, but I found myself caring less about the business, less about the money. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to serve the Lord, you know, more. I wanted to go into the jail more if I could. I wanted to, you know, we've had in some of those loose groups of friends and families were even, some of them were saying, hey, y'all should start a church. You know, they could kind of see like I had this desire to minister and to teach yeah. and, you know, so my, you know, what got me to seminary was I kind of told the Lord, I was like in prayer, I was like, Lord, if you want, you know, I'd like to be in full-time ministry. If that's what you want for me, if that's what you want, you mm-hmm. got to sell my business. You know,
what was the business again?
At the time I had a cell phone repair company.
Okay.
I was, first guy to start a cell phone repair shop, on the Mississippi Gulf Coast there.
Nice, nice.
It kind of became a thing after the, you know, all the phones are glass nowadays, you know?
yeah.
So we'd opened that before there was glass phones, you know, but, a very successful business and yeah. we were doing good. My wife had a hair salon mm-hmm. and, but, anyways, what yeah. was I saying?
Oh, you were laying that fleece before the Lord that he'd
oh, yeah, yeah.
sell your business. Yeah.
So I told the Lord, you know, it's like, you know, if I'm going to move into ministry, if that's your desire, then we need to sell this business. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have it for sale or anything, but I had a gentleman call maybe 3 days later saying, hey, I'd like to talk about buying your business.
Wow.
And it, to me, that was like a little, you know, nudge from the Lord. This is the Lord saying something here. Yeah. I didn't sell it to him. You know, my brother worked in the business and my other brother was interested in keeping it. So I just, they kind of took over the business,
nice.
But I took it as like, okay, maybe this is pointing me to do this full-time ministry. So sold the hair salon. Yeah, my brothers took over the shop, sold our house, and we moved out to Austin, Texas, where I decided to go to seminary at a school out there. And that kind of led me into, you know, full-time ministry. We got out of seminary and we moved back home.
What was the seminary?
It was Austin Graduate School of Theology.
Okay, nice.
And so we'd done that, moved back home, church planted, so with some of those, you know, some of those friends and different people that were wanting to do that, kind of in the messianic world. Mm-hmm. Though during all this time, the Lord, you know, there had been some like seeds planted where the Lord was working on my theology and changing things from that kind of hard, you know, dogmatic and legalistic, judgy type of theology, and really kind of breaking me of some of that and softening me and bring me to a place of respecting, you know, more of the Christian traditions, understanding that in history, like things are happening and people are making decisions for certain reasons and coming to respect the different, you know, broader church traditions. Mm-hmm. You know, we church planted for a little while. After a few years of that, well, one of my brothers kind of like, we let him kind of take the lead on that. And that was when my theology had really come more in line with historic Christianity in a sense. Hmm. And so, you know, different books I would read, The school that I went to was really, really focused on history, mm-hmm. trying to understand, you know, the development of everything. And, you know, as a focus for the kind of messianic movement is real big on Jesus's words, right? If this is Messiah, like his words are more important. And, you know, we would see his words versus Paul sometimes, you know, Peter saying he's hard to understand. And we would say, well, we're going to stick with what Jesus teaches. And the more I kind of really dove into Jesus's words, there were certain themes that just kept coming up in this idea of, you know, mercy and humility, mm-hmm. Submission to authority was a big one. And this is something like all throughout the New Testament. And one of the big ones in Hebrews, you know, obey your elders or mm-hmm. obey your teachers. They look out after your souls. And so I was just, you know, we were in this kind of very independent kind of Christianity. And I was like, well, who are these elders and who are these people? And so, you know, I started to read some of the church fathers, some of the history of the church. Mm-hmm. There was a particular book that was probably one of the most important to kind of cracking that hard shell of like me and the scriptures alone kind of idea.
Sure.
It was this dictionary. It had kind of been compiled of like church fathers that did writings before Nicaea. So it was called Dictionary of Early Christian Beliefs, okay. or something to that effect.
Yeah.
But I was expecting to read, here's these guys, you know, they're going to be agreeing with me because I'm doing so good here interpreting these scriptures, you know. And you start to just see like there's a vast different understandings of, you know, different doctrines and different practices and mm-hmm. different things. And I started to think, well, maybe my interpretation, you know, maybe I'm a little arrogant here to think my interpretation is the right one. And maybe I need to be more open to, you know, other practices. And you start to, go ahead.
Well, what were some examples of some surprises you found in them? Some things that ran contrary to what you believed.
So one of the big ones, you know, coming out of like regular Protestantism, mm-hmm. if you can call it that, you know, into the kind of messianic world was this idea of like Sunday as a holy day of the church or a Sabbath type of thing versus Saturday Sabbath, mm-hmm. Where we saw like in the scriptures, there wasn't a lot of evidence for this, like that the Ten Commandments was changed, you know, like the Saturday Sabbath is part of the Ten Commandments. And so you go to this book and you're expecting to find like, oh, hey, these guys are writing in the 150s and in the 200s and like, and they're really connected to the Jewishness of the movement, right, from the early days. And you're expecting to see this and like, they're all writing about this Sunday and this, the eighth day and coming into new understanding and of this covenant and the symbolisms and everything around it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, if all of these guys are saying this like very early, then maybe there's something I'm misunderstanding about, you know, the covenants and what's going on here.
And the relationship to the scripture, right?
Yeah.
As you said. Yeah.
And you know, when you're thinking through that, I'm like, man, these guys don't even have the scriptures, some of them, like the whole scriptures. If you think of like, you know, if somebody's writing in the 60s or the 70s or the 80s and the whole canon hadn't been formed if you think like New Testament goes.
Right.
And so I'm like, well, you know, if my standard for truth is different than somebody living in 50 AD, then maybe my standard for what is the truth is not accurate. You know, maybe there's more here, you know. And then, you know, and as you read scriptures, you know, church is the pillar and foundation of truth. Things like that start to just be these seeds of saying, well, you know, and at the time I didn't see like the church as some like, you know, monolithic kind of organization, but I still said, well, if the church is, if Paul's saying the church is the truth, well, I should at least read the early people that are part of that church and what are they practicing and what are they doing? You know, and this idea of like unity that Jesus wants, you know, John 17 probably was, I would come back to you over and over, I pray, Father, that they are one, like you and I are one, so that the whole world would know that you sent me. You know, mm-hmm. this for evangelism, which is, you know, in our hearts, that's what we're here to do, is to mm-hmm. evangelize the world. And I'm like, man, he's praying our unity would be this witness. And I'm like, here I am out of unity with the historic church. And I didn't mean, and at the time, I didn't mean that as like a Catholic church or right. a particular organization, but I just said, like, if all the Christians that we have writings of are talking about this, then I should probably get on board with doing it just for the sake of unity and being a part of that. So that's what kind of led me to be open to not participate in the Hebrew Roots and Messianic world, but be more, you know, into mainstream kind of Protestantism, where I'm starting to take on some of the traditions that the church has historically practiced across both traditions, the Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church, the Protestant churches, mm-hmm. largely kept Sunday, right? And yeah. and that became their holy day, and did a Christmas, right? That's not like, there's no Bible holy day for this day, and other things
yeah.
that as a Messianic kind of strict, you know, scripture guy, sola scriptura, we had quit practicing a lot of those things. So I started to bring some of those in, and then my theology was, you know, fitting kind of well under the umbrella of kind of the Anabaptist, nonviolence, turn the other cheek, very, you know, Sermon on the Mount, Jesus-centered. And so I ended up at the Mennonite church because my theology fit well there. And then there was a pastoral opening at the local Mennonite church. The church had been planted 100 years ago. They had not had a pastor for about a year. And the jail chaplain, who I had a relationship with because we were doing jail ministry, he was filling in for them, preaching most Sundays just to help out until they found a pastor. And so me and him chatted about it. He told me about the congregation and you know, how, you know, great people, love the Lord, love the scriptures. And I knew Mennonite theology, you know, though I wasn't a strict, you know, Mennonite or anything like that. Yeah. The church, when I came to meet them and get to know them, they weren't either. You know, Mennonite church planted in a kind of a Southern Baptist, on the Protestant side of the coast, very Southern Baptist influenced theology. So, you know, they're more kind of interdenominational. You know, there was people that had Presbyterian backgrounds, Methodist sure. backgrounds, Mennonite backgrounds, like Lutheran, different groups. Mm-hmm. And but they're really just Bible people, like good, hey, whatever the Bible teaches, you know, that's what we want. And that's what I was. I was like, yeah. You know, Bible teaching within that kind of broader tradition
yeah.
of the historic church, you know.
Yeah. Let's take a little break there, Chris, right. and we'll come back in just a couple of minutes and pick up the rest of Chris's story of how he ended up becoming Catholic. Were you a pastor at this time? You were pastoring that church?
Yeah, yeah. So I came in, yeah. came into the Mennonite church there and pastored for about 2 years gotcha. before exiting. So yeah.
All right. Sounds good. Well, we'll pick that up in a few minutes. And hey, I want to remind you that if you go to chnetwork.org and click stories, you'll find a whole archive of stories, both episodes of the Journey Home program, as well as written stories and short videos from every conceivable background. And so wherever you are coming from, as you explore the Catholic Church, as you ask questions, you'll find someone from a similar background to you. And I bet you'll find their story inspiring and intriguing. So check that out at chnetwork.org. We'll be back again in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Chris's story. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Christopher O'Keefe. He's a former Mennonite pastor. And when we left off, Chris, in your story, we just got to that point in your story where you'd undergone a little bit of a shift theologically, partly because, you know, of studying the early church fathers and seeing some of the differences in there. And it kind of broadened your theology to be more in line with historical orthodoxy, not in the sense of the Orthodox Church, but in the bigger Christian tradition. And that led you to be pastoring this Mennonite mm-hmm. community. So let's pick it up there. What happened next?
So, I was pastoring this community, and they were big Bible people. And I was, I love the scriptures, big Bible guy. And mm-hmm. and so, you know, preaching there and serving there and loving on them and great folks. And, you know, when the focus on like the kind of the center focus of like moral theology comes from Jesus, which is kind of like where I had kind of landed, which is what landed me under that Mennonite umbrella, you know, of really Sermon on the Mount, turn the other cheek, mercy, humility, love as defined by the cross, mm-hmm. right? Loving the enemy, that kind of thing. This was my world. And again, like every year, as I read through scriptures and study through scriptures, that John 17 was just this idea of unity. And in my being, I was very kind of ecumenically minded. You know, the school I'd went to was big on teaching all the traditions and the history so that you could respect them. You might disagree, right? We can't agree on everything, yeah. but where you respect them and you see them as your Christian brothers and sisters. And so I had grown to that place and left behind a lot of that divisive legalistic stuff. But I still couldn't shake some of these verses about submission and these ideas of unity. And like, while I could see all the different traditions as my brothers and sisters, in a large way, there still really wasn't really unity, you know. And then here I am pastoring a congregational church. There's no hierarchy. There's no one really above us. And I'm like, well, who are these people I'm supposed to submit to and obey if there's this theme of submission, you know, and all throughout the New Testament. And anyways, the last books of the Bible that I preached through while I was there was Matthew. And it's probably a common book for pastors to end their pastoral ministry on, and then on their way to the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And because, you know, the themes that are in it, there's a lot of themes on this idea of like authority and submission to authority. And it's because I think, you know, a lot of scholars will say that Matthew is written to a Jewish audience. Mm-hmm. The Jews had an authority and they knew who their authority was. And it was, you know, the chief priests and the Pharisees and those that were leading the synagogues and those who were leading the temple service and all of that. So they had this authority. And so I think Matthew is being written in a lot of ways to let those Jewish first century folks understand that there's a shift in authority that's going to happen, mm-hmm. so that they would be more comfortable switching their allegiance, if you will.
Right.
And so in that you have, you know, Jesus affirming this idea of submitting to authority. And what I found interesting is as a Protestant in a lot of my life, it's easy to like look at problems in a particular church, like the Orthodox Church or the Catholic Church. Oh, here's this bad thing that this patriarch did, or here's this bad thing that this Pope did, or these priests did these bad things and they're not always righteous maybe, or whatever. Well, you know, in Matthew 23, like this kind of broke down some of that for me. And he's like, you know, the scribes and Pharisees, they're kind of the opponents of Jesus, if you will. Mm-hmm. And he's like, hey, they sit on Moses' seat. And it tells you he's talking to the disciples and, you know, the rest of the people there. So this is like his disciples. And he's like, hey, the scribes and Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. Therefore, do what they tell you to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, well, that's gotta be a bad translation or interpretation. Like, you know, you start researching the Greek and looking at all the manuscripts and trying to find out, no, that's what he's saying. Like, but he goes on to say, don't do what they do. They're being hypocrites, and kind of rails on them a little bit the rest of the chapter. But this idea of authority for Jesus was super important. So important that here's these scribes and Pharisees who he's about to say they have all kinds of problems, but he tells his disciples to submit to them.
Right.
You know, and then, you know, throughout those chapters, 16 through 25, you know, there's all this idea of authority and parables about the shifting of authority, you know, the parable of the tenant farmers and how the owner of the vineyard, you know, who represents the father, is going to remove those tenant farmers and place new tenant farmers there. And it's obvious in the context who that is. Mm-hmm. It's these apostles, Peter and the apostles, and these are going to be the new authorities. And as a Protestant, like I didn't have a problem with that.
Right.
Because then I would usually go on to say, and they wrote the New Testament. Mm-hmm. So that's what we follow. We follow the apostles, the New Testament. But there's more there. You know, and you get into reading Paul in Timothy, and he's, which is kind of like him talking about the structure of the church in a lot of ways in 1 Timothy. And he leaves Timothy there as an authority. So he's not one of these 12 that was given authority. In fact, Paul wasn't either, if you're being serious about right. Matthew. Like, that's just those 12. And
neither of them had copies of the Bible to wave around.
Correct. Paul's chosen later by Jesus in this kind of special way. Yeah. And his authority gets recognized by the other apostles as well. But then Paul leaves Timothy in charge. And when you read it in the context, it seems like he expects people to submit to his authority. Like, if you disagree with Timothy, historically, it didn't seem like you could just, like, pick up and start a church next door and be yeah. like, nah, I don't agree with him anymore. And then he's telling Timothy, hey, this is how you pick new deacons and new bishops. Like, this is how you find new men for the authority, you know, to be an authority and to pass this on to pass this kind of deposit of the faith onto. And you start to see this idea of, like, kind of like apostolic succession sort of, you know, like it's right. like this authority passing on. And it seems that Paul would expect the members of the church to submit to that authority. And so all of this stuff just starts to break down, you know, my ideas that, like, we could just have our little church and our own little community separated from the rest of Christianity, and that this would be in line with what Paul would have envisioned as, like, this church that he started. If he starts a church in a particular area, then he would envision that that would stay the church, you know, in this group of authority. And, you know, and if there's a problem with authority, that's on their head to remove, right? Jesus is the head of the church. He's the head of these guys in authority. And if he's got a problem with it, it's on him to remove him, not my job to rebel against them, you know? And so that kind of, that Mennonite real strong, like, Anabaptist focus on, like, submission to authority and humility, non-rebellion, you know, not taking up, you know, not fighting for my rights or what I think is right, you know, like, all of that kind of stuff factored into the way I'm reading and understanding this authority system. And, you know, and without getting into, like, you know, going through doing a teaching on like this authority thing, once it kind of landed, like, Jesus set up authority, fact for me when I landed there. Yeah. And this authority didn't just stop with the apostles and then produce the Bible. And then that's what we had. It was, like, handed on down. Mm-hmm. You know, things like Paul saying the pillar and foundation of truth is the church.
Yeah.
Right. And then questions like, did my statement of faith at my church, could somebody that was living in 40, 45 AD, could they affirm the same statement of faith?
Right, right.
And, like, if it says we believe in a 66 book canon, right? Well, Paul hadn't written anything yet, right? In that early, like, yeah. nothing's been written. And there's probably some writings that were, like, the foundational documents for some of the gospels that were used. But really, there's no New Testament Bible. These guys who are legitimately part of the church, and they can't affirm my statement of faith at my church. And I started to say, well, maybe I have the wrong statement of faith here. Maybe, you know, and not that, you know, doctrine has been, it developed over time, and we learn how to understand, you know, like Trinitarian
right.
theology, like it develops over time as we understand the nature of God better. And then we put it into words and put definitions around things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I understand, like, not everything's going to match, but
right.
that was just, like, this little crack in mm-hmm. my idea of what church was.
Yeah.
And so, you know, eventually it became clear, like, there is this authority that's been handed down and I need to submit to it. You know, I'm preaching through Matthew to submit to authority. Jesus is serious about authority. And, but I'm not submitting to any authority, really. Like, I mean, I had the elders of my church, but it's not, like, the same thing when you think of, like, this church authority being handed down throughout time. And, so I had to start looking, and for me, it was either, you know, Orthodox Church, it seemed, had a claim to a 2,000-year-old church, and the Catholic Church had a claim to a 2,000-year-old church. And so that was kind of what, you know, when I got there, then I, you know, it wasn't so much about scriptures, but about, like, trying to understand the church fathers and history and how they talked about each other. What is the difference in authority there? And, you know, before they kind of split, what was there a consensus on authority? Mm. you know, eventually landing me at the Catholic Church. And I felt really good about that at the time. Mm-hmm. But I do understand there's a lot of debate there, you know, and, sure. and, there's a lot of people from the Hebrew roots and Messianic world that mm-hmm. went the Orthodox route. Right. And I get it. You know, I was very drawn mm-hmm. there as well.
Yeah. What were some of the things that attracted to you and helped make you make that decision to the Catholic Church?
To the Catholic Church?
Yeah.
Well, it really came down to this idea of unity and how unity happens, and then seeing that the early church seemed to use this same idea. Mm. So like, you know, if there's going to be an authority, that's going to unity through authority is going to rest in people, and not in like some ideal or some doctrine or some, you know, book or creed, because those can all be interpreted different mm-hmm. ways. Mm-hmm. But if unity is in people, then there's a person to submit to. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, from everything that I looked at, and I didn't read everything, you know, nobody has that time, but yeah. from what I read and the way I looked, it appeared that there was this kind of Bishop of Rome mm-hmm. for the first many hundreds of years before there was a split around 1000 AD. But in the East and West, there was this talk of him as this kind of unifying bishop. You know, he was this unifying figurehead that had some authority in certain aspects, but, you know, local bishops had authority in other things. And that's all kind of changed over time, too. Things have always been ebbing and flowing. Mm-hmm. But he kind of represented this, like, if you're in communion with him, the bishops that are in communion with him are in communion with one another. Mm-hmm. And you know, that is well mixed with, you know, the idea that you see the Catholic Church after the split continuing to be the evangelists of the world and not, you know, and I don't want to like denigrate the Orthodox Church or anything, you know, but you really see the Catholics going out. And some of the Orthodox Church may be a little more like, this is our territory, and mm-hmm. And they might plant churches where some of their, you know, members move around the world, but they're not really, they weren't really going out so much. And just certain factors that kind of sure. pointed, say, I think this is it. And it was more than I think, but I'd landed pretty firmly. And going into it, you know, I was reading a lot of the Eastern Fathers. I loved their theology. Yeah. I loved their spiritual practices. And I went into the Catholic Orthodox thing actually wanting the Orthodox Church to be the one that this is where I should go. This is the right one. And so the fact that like everything kept pointing this way yeah. against my own desires and originally, then I thought, you know, for me, this is what I think I have to do. This yeah. is where I have to go, you know.
So what did you end up doing with that information, that conviction?
So, you know, it's tough because, you know, if you're a pastor, it's going to cost you your job. And, you know, a lot of friends, you know, and I mean, I don't, where I'm still friends with everybody, but
yeah.
this church that I was pastoring, like, you know, the people, they all loved me. I loved them. Like, we had a really good relationship. It's just a great group of people. We still get along great. You know, great people, but I knew like, I'm not going to be in church with them every week making this decision. And that's hard. And, and you know, I put a lot of time and resources into, you know, seminary education.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know, there's this kind of subconscious, like that'll all be a waste and worthless, you know, going this route. And so that's hard. But what I did with it is, literally like the week that like in my mind, it landed at 100%. I was like, 100%. The Catholic Church is the Jesus's authority on earth, is the kind of the way I've always, you know, in the last couple of years I've used, say, this is Jesus's authority on earth. My job is to submit to it. And so it was a week and a half. I went and met with one of the elders of the church and I, you know, let him know. And I told him, I was like, you know, last time I know y'all were without a pastor for a little while. I said, I'll stay on as long as y'all need me if you want to find a pastor, but this is where I'm going. This is what I'm doing. And so we kind of worked out like, well, hey, stay till here, you know, stay till this date and then leave. And, So I just kind of did it and went and met with the local priest, a couple local priests actually, and just kind of told them like I had decided. And interesting, like they're looking for like, you know, one of them, I was talking to one of the priests and he was like, you know, what are these, you know, doctrines that drew you here and whatever. And there was not like all these, like I hadn't even really researched out most of the Catholic Church's beliefs. Cause like, well, if this is the authority and if they're the interpretive authority, you know, these kind of keys given to the church, you know, to Peter and the church to make these interpretive decisions. Then I was just like, well, I'm going to submit, you know? But I went and kind of just said, this is what I'm going to do. There was a, you know, a book I went and read on the Eucharist, on transubstantiation, specifically, cause it was one of those doctrines that I was like, well, I know I have to agree here and I want to make sure I can in good faith, you know, agree. And it was one of those doctrines that, you know, a lot of Catholics will speak about some of their doctrines to Protestants. Protestants hear that and they are interpreting it through the words that the way they use them, and they kind of talk past each other.
Right.
So there was some things that I understood that I just misunderstood them, basically because the way that the you know, Catholic language would talk about certain things, Protestants hear in a certain way. I heard it sounded like they were talking differently. Anyways.
Yeah. All right. Well, what's happened since then? Because now you ended up, you're doing an important work of mercy. You're helping to bury the dead. Talk about what's happened since and how you ended up in that line of work and all that.
So when my family immigrated from Ireland to South Mississippi in the mid-1800s, mm-hmm. They very quickly got into the funeral business in 1865. And so, you know, my grandfathers and great-grandfathers and great, you know, all up the line for sixth generation in the business now, but they had done this on the Mississippi Gulf Coast since 1865. And even my dad did it for a period of time when I was young. I remember him, you know, being a funeral director and mortician and all. And it's kind of full circle. You know, he left the family business and ended up in ministry, and a lot of that left the Catholic Church and then come back around. And, you know, when I was leaving pastoring, I was looking for something, and I had helped out a little bit during COVID when they were really busy. Just, you know, my uncle had asked me to say, "Hey, can you put a suit on and come help us on some services? Things are real busy." And I found a lot of ministerial kind of satisfaction in the work.
Yeah.
You know, like here's people in the community that have a real need, and not everybody can do it. It can be difficult work.
Right.
But it felt right. It felt special. It felt like God's work. And so when I was looking for a job, you know, I went and chatted with my uncle and jumped on board. And you get some of that. It's my heritage, you know, in my family. It seems to be ministerial and special. And, you know, and it helps pay the bills, you know. Yeah. And so kind of the, when you put it all together, you know, it felt right. And I'm right where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've had people ask me like, "Are you going to try to be, you know, a deacon, or are you going to start a podcast or whatever?" And you know, I don't know where the Lord has me called to serve, but I do know for a fact, and I love, one of the things I love about Catholic doctrine is this priesthood of the home, calling, this calling to my family. One of the things that was always important to me when I was pastoring, I was like, you know, I heard the stories about preacher's kids, because they're kind of neglected in a lot of circles, at least growing up, you know. And I wanted to make sure that they got my first and best ministry and service, you know. And so I get to really focus on the family and being a good good priest in my home, and then you know, serving my community in the funeral business. And when it comes to serving, just kind of pause, mm-hmm. you know, because kind of go practice, go to the liturgies and worship God and just absorb all of this. Yeah. And you know, he'll move me when it's time,
right.
You know?
Yeah. Especially if he finds you ready in doing the, yeah. putting the first things first.
Yeah, I'm trying not to jump the gun or yeah. go after something that maybe it's not the right thing or the right time, mm-hmm. you know.
So. No, that's so good. It reminds me of that old classic, you know, the apostolate, the work of the apostle, soul of the apostolate. Sorry. Yeah, that old classic, which of course, focuses precisely on that fact that, you know, we have this desire to bear fruit and to do ministry and to do good works, and that's good. But like the soul of that is being faithful to, again, the liturgy and the sacraments and prayer and that inner life, that inner work first, and then allowing God to then lead us into those ministries. And so that's a wise course, you know. So we have about 10 minutes left. I wanted to circle back on a couple of things. One was you talked about how early in your life, in your Christian journey, the emphasis in your community and your theology was kind of on the more legalistic side, you know, just some of it specifically and some of it just sort of like by just kind of the atmosphere of the thing. I tended that direction. And then you swung more in the other direction, but still, you know, wrestled with, you know, how the gospel still calls us to unity and to submission. And so that, you know, there's two extremes there, kind of a real legalism, and then you might call like a universalism, you know, that you could go too far in that direction. Talk a little bit about what you found in the Catholic theology that kind of brings the right emphases between those two.
Yeah. So in my past, mm-hmm. there was, strong, you know, legalistic focus. And the more I would read, you know, some of the church fathers and even, you know, some of the Eastern way of talking about things, which like in the West, both in the Catholic Church and in the Protestant Church in the West, we get a lot of very kind of like theological treatises, very rational, systematic, and it's easy to like build this kind of like line, this in and out line. And so in my bachelor's degree is in mathematics. So that's where that's how my mind works. Like naturally I'm very like give me the black and white, give me the numbers. But then as I started to read, you know, the more of, you know, the Eastern fathers and the mystics of the church and theologians today that would kind of talk about their thing, I'd start to see well, it's not really either or, but there's really truths on both sides of like the debate, you know, and you could say the predestination debate, for instance, within the Protestant churches. And mm-hmm. you start to see like, well, hey, these guys really pull, you know, they're not taken from either. Like these ideas pre-exist, both of these arguments, but they're just looking at it from a different angle mm-hmm. where there's truths in both. Mm-hmm. And it's something that God's doing. But really what led my journey really came to see like, it's so easy for our theology to be kind of human focused, humanistic, and like what's required of me? What am I supposed to do? What is he supposed to do or she supposed to do? Yeah. And what I started to see is like a lot of the church fathers, and then I find this a lot in like in the catechism and in the Catholic Church, is that it's really Jesus focused. Like what has Jesus done? And yeah, like our life in him is kind of like, you know, our response to this. Like if Jesus is coming and includes the world, you know, like Paul says, if one died for all, therefore all died in Corinthians. And he's trying to use this real inclusive language so that it gives us something like, man, like Jesus is for us. Mm-hmm. And then our response to that is out of love. Our response to that is due to that. And so, when I look at the Catholic Catechism and read through, and I remember going through the Catechism, not sure like if I was going to have run into a lot of doctrines that are going to be really difficult to deal with, because like I came in on this idea of authority, so I wasn't testing out every doctrine. Like I was coming to submit whatever this teaches, you know. And as I read it, I was like, man, this is all the same stuff that I'd been exposed to, for a long time on the East. That kind of broke me out of this, is that it's all Jesus focus.
Yeah.
You know, he is the one who holds it all together. He's the answer of every prayer. And yes, we might ask someone to pray for us or come to receive his grace through a sacrament, but it all comes from him. Like he's the center and focus of everything. And, And it, I just found like when he becomes the focus, then those black and whites and walls kind of break down. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the I think it's the old Moravian cry, they were a group of missionaries, but the cry, you know, if I'm getting my history correct here, is, you know, may the lamb that was slain receive the reward of his suffering. Mm. Right? It makes the gospel, instead of it being about saving people about them, it makes saving people about Jesus. Mm. Like, Jesus died for the world, so our evangelism should be about him, right? Mm. Like, he paid the price for that soul over there.
Yeah.
And so for his sake, I want to share the gospel.
Yeah.
Instead of it being about them. It's also about them, right? Mm-hmm. He makes it both. It's both and.
Yeah.
But, it's beautiful. I would say that was really the Jesus focus is what broke me out of that. And then what I found in the Catholic Church is it's all Jesus focus. Like,
right,
the sacraments, the scriptures. I love how Bishop Barron, he said, all these things are to get us to him, to point us to Jesus. Like,
right,
everything in the church, the sacraments, the sacramentals, the scriptures, the liturgies.
That's beautiful. Well, there's just a few minutes left here, you know, thinking about those who may be listening or watching, in particular, those coming from a similar theological background, and even more particularly for those who are perhaps in Protestant ministry or other ministry outside the church who are asking some of these questions, what's a word of encouragement you can give them on this continued journey? Yeah.
I would say the number one thing is look into all of your Christian brothers and sisters, the different traditions, to understand, you know, what has the Catholic Church done and taught historically from their perspective, and try to find voices that are using language that is understandable within that Protestant world. For me, one of the voices that was really important was Bishop Robert Barron, mm-hmm, who, my whole life I'd heard about Catholic doctrine, Catholicism from Catholic friends and community members, and they would use language that would kind of talk past me. I didn't really understand like what they were saying, because like I would hear those words, but there's the way Protestants use those words, which is different, and so I didn't really understand. But when Bishop Robert Barron was like talking about the Catholic faith, I remember listening to this 3-hour podcast where he's talking about the Catholic faith, and at the end of it, I was like, well, I believe all of that, you know, and I thought myself as a very biblically rooted guy. You know, and I come to understand that, maybe the way these other folks were talking about Catholicism was they were using language that didn't match up with the way I use those terms theologically, you know, where Bishop Barron understood his audience and was really using language that spoke to me. So I would say the word of encouragement is like, try to understand your different brothers and sisters from their perspective, you know, and
yeah.
It's so easy to like, you know, put up a straw man and, mm-hmm, and knock it down and be like, oh, I disagree with that. Oh, I disagree with that. Oh, they're wrong.
Yeah.
But usually when you get to understand their own point of view from their perspective, you find like, I think we're a lot closer. I think Protestants, Catholics, mm-hmm, Orthodox and Catholics, I think we're a whole lot closer on most things than we know and realize.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Chris, for your story and for that word of encouragement, and also for the continued works of mercy you do through your work.
Thank you for having me.
Having you here, yeah. I pray that Chris's story is an inspiration to you on your own journey. I loved his word of encouragement there at the end. You know, that there's this connection between humility and our search for truth. Really, we have to approach it with the right mind and heart. We have to stand under in order to understand, you know, you might put it. And so let's keep that in mind as we all continue our journey seeking the truth, trying to understand each other and get the differences clear so that we can, you know, have real dialogue that seeks the truth and leads each person closer to Christ. I also want to remind you, especially as Chris shared, again, he was a pastor who the Holy Spirit opened up to the Catholic Church. And we recognize that that's a difficult journey. So especially if you are a pastor, a Protestant pastor, or some other tradition who's thinking about becoming Catholic, we want to pray with you and for you on your journey. That's really the core of our work here at the Coming Home Network. And so please reach out to us at chnetwork.org. We'd love to talk to you, pray with you, pray for you. We have all kinds of resources to help you on your journey. But in the meantime, we'll be back again next week with another story of faith and conversion. It's great to be here with you. In the meantime, God bless.